Hello, we hope you enjoy this podcast of Conversations. There are many, many more than 1,000 in fact, on our website, abc.net.au/conversations. And we're on iTunes as well, and it's all free. You're listening there to the great American violinist, Yehudi Menuhin. There's a photo of Yehudi Menuhin that was taken back in the 1920s when he was probably just about 11 years old. You can see in the picture little Yehudi is very neatly turned out and he's seated at a table looking down, projecting his gaze onto this antique violin that's in front of him. By this stage, at 11, Yehudi was a child prodigy and had been a world-famous star for several years. Yehudi and his brilliant sister Hepzibah became glamorous teenagers, and eventually his very name became a byword for innate genius, like Einstein. The photo is actually on the back of one volume of a biography of the great man, written by Philip Bailey, who is my guest for you today. Philip was the personal assistant to Yehudi Menuhin for several decades, and in many ways Philip could hardly believe his luck, because Philip had idolised Yehudi Menuhin and Hepzibah Menuhin since he'd seen them perform the Sydney Town Hall when Philip was just a boy. Philip's biography runs to two volumes and it's called Yehudiana, Reliving the Menuhin Odyssey. Hello, Philip.
Hello, Richard.
Let's start with your childhood because your story overlaps just so lovely in a lovely way with Yehudi's story. Whereabouts did you grow up?
In Sydney, at a suburb called Beecroft, which in those days was a mixture of market gardens and a village, really. And it was a glorious place to grow up because we had bushland to play in. There were no regulations. Parents didn't say, oh, watch out for black snakes or watch out for funnel-web spiders. We simply dealt with them as we came across them. And we roamed free in a way that I think kids these days are not allowed to. And it was a village atmosphere and people looked after you. If I got out of, say, at the age of six, I remember once I got out of my comfort zone on my tricycle and went too far. And I was about 5 kilometres from home and I panicked. I went into a house and started crying, and eventually they got out of me my surname, and they rang up my parents, and a brother of mine, Stephen, came to collect me and put his arm around me and said, you'll be all right, and sort of guided me home. And it was that sort of place where it was a wonderful place. And they had marvellous fire engines, and the firemen in those days had wonderful brass helmets and fantastic uniforms, none of this plastic and fiberglass. And I wanted to be a fireman, so much so that I set fire to a tree in the bushland so that they would come and...
You set fire to a tree to attract them. These
and
fascinating
it did. It did attract them. In fact, the tree went up much quicker than I thought. And I raced home and Mum said, hop in the bath. And so I did. And as I was getting out of the bath and she was about to dry me, I heard this the fire engine, of course I'd missed them because I was so petrified of what I'd done. And Mum said, oh, the fire engine sounded a bit close. Philip, have you, and she smelt my head. She said, have you, and I said, well, Mum, it wasn't me, it was Michael Davis. He had the matches, it wasn't me. And she said, now look, stop blubbering. She said, this is a secret between you and me. I was six. This is a secret. It'll never be mentioned again. So I blessed my mum in that moment.
But Beecroft is nearly not there. There's,
well, it was nearly not there, right, at all. It could well have been a conflagration, yes.
You moved to the country. Why was that? Why did your family move there?
Well, it was a very smart move on the part of my father, who's an accountant. And, of course, he had six boys. And the eldest boy had been sent to Armidale, to the Armidale school, to straighten him out as a teenager, as it were. And that had been a great success, so another brother went as a boarder. And then Dad had another three boys to put through school. And he realised he couldn't afford boarding fees for all of us. So he found out that at the Armidale School, the bursarship had come up for offer. So he applied for the job and got it and put his accountancy practice on hold in Sydney while he educated us for at a discount at TAS.
And you loved it, didn't you?
I loved it. I loved that move to the country. And my mother did too. She loved going to the country and becoming part of country life. And but then after 3 years, Dad decided to resume his career in Sydney and just overnight said, we're going back to Sydney.
Did you resent that?
I did. I in protest, I wore my TAS uniform to a primary school in Sydney for a whole year as a protest against having been uprooted and taken back to Sydney.
And then one day in Sydney, your uncle dragged you to a concert at the Sydney Town Hall.
That's right.
Was this against your will?
Oh, absolutely, because I wanted to do something else, like playing cricket. And I was dragged, kicking and screaming, to this recital thing. And Sydney Town, I didn't know what it was. I said to Dad, what's a recital? Why am I? He said, I don't know what a recital is, but you're about to find out. And but my uncle was very much steeped in music. And it's interesting how a chance happening like this changed one's life, because I resented the whole intrusion in my Saturday afternoon. But when Hephzibah came on stage, I fell in love with her immediately, because being the youngest of six boys, I realised quite early on that Mum and Dad had been trying for a daughter. And I looked at Hephzibah and I thought, she'll fit the bill. Terrific. And if she'll come home with me this afternoon, it'll satisfy Mum. But and then Yehudi, what fascinated me about him, I could sort of just read, and my uncle passed me the program, and it said the man coming on stage to play the violin shortly started his career when he was eight. And I thought, hang on a minute, I'm eight. How is it possible for an eight-year-old to start an international career? And so I thought, oh, well, and he can speak six languages. And I thought, now I know what a recital is. It's a freak show. Bring it on. I was absolutely fascinated. Bring it on. And he walked on stage and he didn't look like a freak at all. It was fantastic. No. And I fell in love with him. If anyone had said to me in Sydney Town Hall in 1951, you will spend 20 years of your life working and travelling and turning pages and that sort of thing for them, I would have said, you're mad.
Now, they were in their, what, I suppose their 20s at this stage, weren't they?
Yes, late 20s, early 30s, yes.
Paint me a picture of, and they were both incredibly good looking, weren't they?
Yes.
Brother and sister on stage.
Yes.
Magnetic. Geniuses, magnetic.
Yeah, the charisma. They had this wonderful rapport. And the rapport in their playing came flooding across through the music. They had this magnetism, and they were obviously, what impressed me as an eight-year-old was there as a brother and sister spending Saturday afternoon playing together and not having any arguments. They were obviously loving what they were doing, and I thought, gee, that's magic. That's
well, they, could you see that? Could you see that?
Oh, yes. Absolutely. The radiating a sense of achievement and a sense of togetherness. Everything they were doing was, and I'd seen then later on how they did it, how with hard rehearsal, and every note in its right spot.
Now, at that time, both Yehudi and Hephzibah were both married to Australians. Tell me how that came about, the story of how Yehudi and Hephzibah were married to these Australians.
Nola Nicholas, who was the heiress to the Aspro fortune, at the age of 19, was sent by her father with her brother, who was a year or so older, on a grand tour of Europe. Part of the reason was to get Nola away from her boyfriend in Melbourne. And so they sent them all off, the both brother and sister, to London. And while they were there, they were, because they in Melbourne, they had been, the Nicholas family had been patrons of the Melbourne Symphony. The conductor then introduced Yehudi backstage at the Albert Hall to Nola. And he fell in love with Nola's handshake, which is an extraordinary thing. And it was this firm...
It must have been some handshake.
Well, you know how Australian parents at that time, at a certain time, said, no wet fish, no trout.
Right.
You know, if you're going to shake somebody's hand, give it a good old.
Mm.
And Nola had grown up in that tradition and Morris crushed Yehudi's hand. And he fell in love with the handshake. And 3 months later, they were married.
Hephzibah, though.
Well, yes, she was devastated because here suddenly was her brother, beloved brother, getting married, and who knows where they might end up. So she turned to Lindsay, Nola's brother, and said, I'm going to marry you.
So brother and sister.
Married brother and sister.
That's,
that just seems kind of
weird, doesn't it?
Yeah, and creepy and and odd. I don't know. It's not incestuous, but it seems somehow odd, doesn't it?
It's very odd because Lindsay, Nicholas, had his own girlfriend and was building or putting the finishing touches to a big homestead in the Western Districts of Victoria at the time. And he was heading back to Australia to get married and perhaps settle down on this property. And he said to Hephzibah, when she proposed to him, he said, well, look, actually, I'm a bit busy, and I've got other things on. She said, oh, it doesn't matter, I can wait, it doesn't matter. And let's get on with it. So they did. It was just an extraordinary.
So she ordered Lindsay,
yes,
Nicholas, to marry her, essentially. And,
yes.
And that was that. So they got married. Mm. And then Hephzibah settled at that point in country Victoria for a while, didn't she? How did the exotic Hephzibah Menuhin go settled in country Victoria?
With difficulty. She arrived here November 38. Australia had been, southeastern Australia had been in the middle of a catastrophic drought for years. And then at the time when they left, Lindsay fell seriously ill in Melbourne, so the introduction to Melbourne was pretty grim. But eventually he recovered in January and took his new bride out to this homestead. And the whole of southeastern Victoria was affected by bushfire.
Oh, that was
the huge Black
gigantic
Thursday.
Black Thursday. Right.
And that was her introduction to country news, Victoria.
And she saw that, did she?
She saw all that.
And then what happened to her? I mean, did she
well, she
of course
tried.
She couldn't do what she did then, which was play the piano.
Well, she did. Actually, the war intervened. And during the war, gave her an opportunity to play for troops, play for charity organisations, and she formed a quartet and did a lot of war work, playing for good causes. And she also then brought into her house a lot of refugees, and she opened her heart to refugees.
I wonder how she got on in country Victoria, though, as this kind of exotic bird.
A bit difficult, because in those days, you went to the village hall for a dance, the girls are down one end, the boys are the other end of the bar. And
girls called Gladys or
that's
Edna.
Right.
And here's Hephzibah.
And they wore gloves and handbags, and Hephzibah had sort of afternoon teas, and she couldn't bear the food that was served, and she introduced things like nuts for people to eat, and they weren't. And she told these women in country Victoria to stand up for their rights. She was a feminist early on.
So she left, though.
Yes.
Under what circumstances? Tell me about that, about her leaving.
Okay. Well, she had two children. Two boys, but country life in Victoria palled after a while. And she started an affair with a paint manufacturer, as it turned out, in a refugee again in Melbourne, scandalised Melbourne society. And then eventually she fell for a psychologist who was doing work in Sydney at a mental institution and for the New South Wales Tramways, of all things. And she fell for him, and one morning she just left, said goodbye to the family and the boys, and off she went to Sydney for a while, and then eventually to London.
Did she see her children again?
Oh, yes, she did. Not for quite a number of years, but then as they matured and as they travelled and as she came here on tours with Yehudi, they got together. They parted good company.
My guest in conversation today is Philip Bailey, and Philip was for several decades the personal assistant to the great violinist Yehudi Menuhin. You're hearing his story today. She took on some idealistic causes during the war, didn't she? She would be there in soup kitchens, doing things like that, helping refugees. Yehudi took on causes as well. What do you see as the difference in the way Yehudi Menuhin took on great causes and Hephzibah did it?
Well, as I've just described, Hephzibah worked from the ground up. She went to the coalface. She adopted children. She opened a house to refugees. I remember going to see her in London many times, and she'd be cooking on a stove a big pot of stew, and outside would be 20 early Afghan refugees waiting for something to eat. Whereas Yehudi had a different... He wasn't comfortable with all of that. He preferred to lobby prime ministers, princes, and kings and queens. He went at the top and said things. Now we must do something about this, and they all nodded politely. And but that was his way of working.
Did you get the sense from Hephzibah she had deep regret about walking away from those?
Yes.
I mean, you can see why she had to leave, but leaving children behind.
Yes, yes. I at the end, as she was dying, she said rather poignantly that the reconciliation between her eldest boy and the man she ran away with, as it were, was heartfelt, and she died feeling that at least they had come together.
Philip, by the time then you saw them perform at the Sydney Town Hall in 1951, the war was over. Yehudi had just not that wasn't long after he'd actually performed to the survivors of a concentration camp.
Yes, that was.
In the concentration camp?
Yes, Bergen-Belsen. He went there 3 months after he'd been liberated. Horrific still. In fact, after the British liberated Bergen-Belsen, 10,000 inmates died after the British liberated. It was an extraordinary
situation. Malnutrition and the like, yeah.
Actually, they just couldn't save them. And Yehudi got there 3 months later and saw a lot of that. In a sense, it had been very much cleaned up, and he played for the survivors there.
I was just reading his name. Yehudi means the Jew, doesn't it?
Yes.
And his parents did that as a kind of a slap in the face to anti-Semitism.
Yes, that's right.
I wonder what it must have been like for him to see that, to see those survivors.
Well, it was funny enough. His main purpose was to forgive the Germans. And in writing the book, it became very clear that he had two main aims, and he made a mistake when he went to Bergen-Belsen or afterwards. He went from there to Hamburg and found himself in a position where he asked an orchestra who was about to play the Mendelssohn violin concerto. The leader was about to play in a concert the Mendelssohn, which had been banned in Germany because it was by
Jewish. Yes.
Yeah. And he said, look, I'll play the Mendelssohn instead. What about that? And they moved over and they let him play. Now, the word of that got back to Bergen-Belsen. And I spoke to one of the survivors who lives in Sydney. And she said that was a mistake. For him to unilaterally forgive the Germans at that time was too soon. She said it was far too soon. And he made some enemies because of that.
So by the time you saw them perform at the Sydney Town Hall, Hepzibah's marriage had broken up.
No, in fact, she was still going. No, she didn't leave until 1955, so she still had 4 years to run.
And how was the state of Yehudi's marriage at that point?
Married Diana, yes.
He'd married then. So after you'd seen that concert, you were, 8 years old, I think, and you went to boarding school, wanted to be a farmer for a while, didn't you?
Yeah.
And that didn't pan out, did it?
No, it was too expensive.
So how you ended up leaving Australia and went to the UK for a while?
Yes, I was doing a master's degree at university, and I ran into a couple of difficult subjects, which I was really having trouble with. And a friend of mine came one day and said, look, let's go to England for Christmas. As you did, jump on a plane and go to England. So I did. I agreed to do that and stayed there 5 years before I came back. And it was while I was teaching at Gordonston in Scotland that I met the husband of Yehudi Menuhin's secretary.
Yeah, now tell me how this unfolded. You were there in Gordonston, that's that school in Scotland that Prince Charles famously went to.
And Prince Philip and the other princes, yes.
All right.
I was there with Prince Andrew.
Yeah. Were you? Did you teach him?
No, I didn't. He pulled a face at me once outside a classroom as he walked past.
Cheeky bugger.
Cheeky, yes, doing that sort of thing. And I thought, an heir to the throne has just poked a face at me through the window. What do I do? Prince Charles said to me later on, he said, you should have gone out and belted him one.
Six of the best.
Yeah, six of the best.
For the member of the royal family.
It was interesting there. Prince Andrew came up to me in the school drive one day and he said, sir, it's a rum show going on in Australia.
Rum show?
Rum show. It was the Whitlam dismissal. And I said, why is that? He said, well, it's very difficult for for Her Majesty. And I said, Her Majesty knows exactly what to do, and that's nothing. So we had quite a joke about
Rum show.
Yeah.
So there you are as a teacher in Gordonston, and this is what I suppose you think your life is going to be. And you enjoyed being a teacher, didn't you?
I loved being a teacher. Yes.
And that's when you met this South African poet.
Yes.
Tell me about this pub meeting you had.
Well, he persuaded me to go to the pub. I didn't want to go to the pub. I needed to do some marking and preparation of lessons, but he finally prevailed. And I went to this pub, and it was smoky, and I didn't like the beer. But before I left Australia, my mother said to me, best advice she ever gave, she said, Philip, when you're travelling, keep asking questions. Take an interest in people. It's good manners, after all, but you never know when you might need a feed or whatever. And so I was sitting in this pub, and I'd asked this African poet everything I could about his life. He didn't ask me one thing about Australia or anything else.
So he was indifferent, and you were being polite,
absolutely,
were you?
Absolutely. Right. And I could hear Mum at the back of my brain saying, keep asking questions. And I kept saying, oh, Mum, you know, this is boring. Anyhow, eventually I ran out of things to say, and I said to this chap, what does your wife do? And he said, I don't know why you're asking me that question. You'll never meet her. And there's no import to you. I said, listen, Sonny boy, I need to go back to school to do some marking and that sort of thing. I don't like the beer. I don't like the smoke. Now, answer the question. He said, you Australians are bolshy. And I said, you haven't seen bolshy yet. Answer the question. And he said, well, if you must know, she's a secretary. And I said, oh. And I could hear Mum saying, keep at it, keep at it. And I said, what sort of secretary? And he said, you do go on. I said, answer the question. I'm out of here. And he said, well, if you must know, she's a secretary to a musician. And I uttered the words, said, well, didn't know a musician had secretaries. And he said, this one's got, he's so famous, he's got five. And I said, five? Who is he? Fateful question. He said, being an Australian, you'd have never heard of him. Oh, I thought, South African. How dare they? What a put down. And I've given up this night, and this man is... So I thought, and Mum was saying, come on, ask the question. I said, who is he? And he said, Yehudi Menuhin. Well, I fell off my bar stool and frothed at the mouth, and he said, do you know who you're talking about? I said, of course I do. 1951, Sydney Town Hall recital with Hepzibah. And he said, well, would you like to meet them? And I said, how? And he said, come to Switzerland in summer. Summer holidays, and there's a music festival Menuhin runs there, and we all moved from London over to Switzerland, and oh, he's a mate of mine, and you can meet him. So, and that's what happened.
So, yes, tell me about your first fateful meeting then with the great man, Yehudi Menuhin. This is, what, 1976, thereabouts?
1976.
Tell me about your first meeting with the man.
Well, it, chance, of course, has played a big role in all this. And I had an old diesel Mercedes car. And I have to admit, it did belch out quite a lot of black smoke, more than a London taxi and buses. It was pretty grim. But I drove it up the mountains to Stade, where they had this music festival. And I polluted quite a lot of Switzerland with this car. By the time I got to Stade, people were coughing. And I had to park it on a hill because it wouldn't start properly. And it was an old bomb, really. But one Sunday, I was having lunch with the secretary and this South African poet. Phone rang, and it was Yehudi asking help. He said, I need to get to rehearsal, and my boys have taken the car, and I can't get a taxi. What am I going to do? And the secretary said, well, there's a young Australian staying with us here. He'll pop round in the car in a minute. So I went out and got the car started, belching smoke, and I had to reverse all the way up this mountain into Yehudi's... into Yehudi's garden. It was, he had a chalet perched on top of this hill. By the time I got into the garden, the whole of the garden was full of black smoke. I have to admit that. The door opened, this beautiful chalet, and out he stepped with his wife, who was in a white silk suit. She was a former ballet dancer. And both of them were immediately enveloped with his black fumes. And I had the boot open to put the violin in and all that. And he came walking down the stairs, and I thought, well, here he is, my hero. I'm actually going to meet Yehudi Menuhin, if only I could have a camera of it. And he came through this cloud of black smoke with a handkerchief over it. He said, for goodness sake, get out of it. And I said, would you like to put the violin in the boot? He said, oh, don't put the strand in the boot. For goodness sake, get in the car. And as we drove down the mountain, he said, what's wrong with this car? And I said, oh, it's got something to do with altitude and mixtures. And he said, anyhow, I'm putting a stop to all this pollution. He said, next week, I'm taking delivery in London of an electric car imported from America. And that was the end of the conversation. I dropped him off at the church. And he said, now, for goodness sake, go out of Switzerland. Get away. I don't want to see you again. It's terrible.
What an unpropitious meeting.
It was. And I went away on more travels, came back a week later, and the secretary said, the boss wants to see you next door. And I thought, oh, I've been fined or something's happened. So I crept up to the Menuhin Chalet and was ushered into his presence. And he said, what are you doing for the next couple of years? I said, I'm going back to Australia to start my career in teaching again. He said, no, you're not. You're going to London and you're going to take delivery of that electric car for your sins, and you can have 10% of the profits of all the cars we sell. And I thought, oh, well, it'll look good on my CV anyway, you know, a bit of a lark. And,
sell what cars? What was this scheme he had?
He had been introduced to an inventor in America who had converted American limousine for electric power with putting 90 lead acid batteries in it. It weighed 4.5 tons. It was heavier than a big truck. But it was designed to run on American freeways where there are fewer hills and...
So Yehudi Menuhin is asking you, this yes. Australian who's only given him a lift once, yes. to manage a scheme he set up to yes. sell electric cars yeah. to the world?
And that's how he operated. He had these projects all the time. He wake up every day with a new project in his head, and this was one he had. So I thought, oh, well, I may as well. It'll look good on the CV.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler. On ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.
My guest today is Philip Bailey. Philip saw Yehudi and Hepzibah Menuhin perform, the great violinist and his sister, the pianist. He saw them perform in 1951 at the Sydney Town Hall. He was brought there against his will, became entranced by this extraordinary brother and sister performance. And years later, by chance, ended up becoming the personal assistant to Yehudi Menuhin. By way of Yehudi Menuhin, the classical violinist, inviting Philip to take charge of a scheme he had to sell electric cars to the world. Now, this is a delightful turn of events. How did it go, by the way, just quietly? I don't think I've driven in a Menuhin lately. How did it go?
Not well.
No.
Poor Yehudi, he had a passion for big, flashy American cars, Cadillacs and that sort of thing. It sounds extraordinary, doesn't it? Because he was such a simple man by appearance. But he loved flashy American cars. And this inventor had taken this flashy American car and put electric motor in it and batteries. So he thought that'll be lovely for London. He was ill-advised because Menuhin lived in Highgate. Highgate.
Right.
It is High. And when the American inventor brought the car to London, I drove with him out to Highgate. And first thing he said to me, where are the freeways? And I said, freeways? London doesn't have freeways. Well, what city doesn't have freeways? God, there's traffic lights, because every time you stop the traffic light, the power went down, you see, to start up again, 4.5 tons. And then we went up this hill. He said, why are we going up this hill? I said, because Menuhin lives in Highgate. Oh, no one told me about Highgate. So we got up there, and the car had run out of electric power. It was disastrous. Anyhow, the whole thing blew up, literally blew up.
But that didn't affect your relationship with Yehudi Menuhin. He wanted you to work with him.
Yes. Well, after the car, I sent the car back to America because it was such a headache. And he said to me once, I went to him and said, look, I'm sorry, I put it in the container, it's gone back to America. And he said, what are you going to do now? And I said, well, I think I'll go back to Australia. And he said, no, hang around. I need someone to travel with me and to look after all my travel things. And, you know, there are all sorts of things you can do on tour. So that's when I started.
So are you kind of like the equivalent of a tour manager or even a roadie?
Yeah, a roadie. I was a classical musician's equivalent of a roadie. Anything that was required on tour fell to my... And it was busy, and it was very rewarding culturally, because I had marvelous concerts every night and working for lovely people. I mean, they were very good to work for. They were demanding, but not in the sense of being unsympathetic. They were very good.
So working that closely to him, you see him in large matters and small matters as well. Yeah. How did you come to see Yehudi Menuhin as a man? He seems, when I've seen him being interviewed, he seems to have this kind of fierce concentration, as I said, and this lovely childlike quality to him as
yes.
well.
Yes. I think an innocence which was engaging, that he would... His childlike enthusiasms for things, for inventions, for people, and that was very infectious. And we had lovely discussions about childish sort of things. He was very disappointed about the electric car, but he got over it. And then he would take a huge interest in what you were doing. I started an antique restoration business with Tim, my partner, and he took a huge interest in that because here were people using their hands and simple things like that, and a sort of woodworking, which he was never allowed to do because his hands were so valuable. But to have a chisel in his hand and to mould something or use a lathe or all that, the tactile, he was a very tactile man. He loved wood and he loved creative activities.
Yes. Now, you mentioned your partner Tim and how you set up an antique restoration business together. Now, that was greatly aided, I understand, by Yehudi's second wife, Diana. Tell me a bit about her and how she came into Yehudi's life and how she was able to help you.
Yes, it's a very long story. And Diana, during the war, Yehudi and Diana started an affair in London. In fact, we're about to hear some music later on that was recorded in London at the time when he met Diana. And so that wasn't unusual at the time. And and the marriage to Nola was coming apart. She had found a lover as well when he was away a lot.
She was a ballerina, wasn't she?
Diana was a ballerina. And, of course, Yehudi fell in love with all that theatre, and he was very much in love with Pavlova early on as a little boy. So Diana fitted the bill, but as it transpired, Yehudi decided, with Nola's urging, that they should stay together for the sake of the children. But Diana wasn't having that. And so she chased him to America and, in a sense, precipitated the divorce. And they were married in 1947. So, and then Diana was very much in control. She treated him like a boy very often. She often said, well, of course, he's never grown up. And she treated him accordingly. That grated on a lot of people. She wasn't easy. She was very tough, and she was boisterous. And
a lot of people didn't like her, did they?
No, they
didn't. But she was very kind to you, wasn't she?
Very kind. She was very suspicious of me first off because I was Australian, and Australia meant Nola. And Yehudi was nervous because he had to get her approval for me to stay on. And I was only on approval. But little by little, I got onto wavelengths with Diana, and my job really was to keep her happy.
And then he'd be happy, right?
And of course, we go off to antique shops. So we might be in Bath at a festival. Yehudi'd be soaring away with the violin, and she'd say, come on, we'll do an antique raid. So, and she was brilliant. She'd walk into an antique shop, and she could smell a bargain. And she taught me a lot about Georgian architecture and Georgia furniture. And the opportunity came up because she said to me one day there was some veneers coming off the dining room table and the chair was, the joints were loose. And she said, get those fixed up, Philip, find a restorer. And I couldn't. In London, could not find a restorer who would give me a quote and would do the thing in a reasonable time. So I said to Tim, who'd just arrived from Australia, and I knew he'd sold a house. I knew he had some money. I had no money. I said to Tim over a drink, have you got any money? And he said, well, yes, but why? And I said, well, because you and I are going to start a business. He said, what? Antique restoration. He said, you're mad. You don't know the difference between a chair and a table. And I said, well, I'm an economist, and I'm Division of Labour, and we're going to put restorers in their workshop, and they'll do what they're good at, and you and I will do the front of house work. And that's what we did. And Diana fell for this scheme, threw money behind it, and so did Yehudi. And she was a great supporter of what we were doing. And she made it possible for us to establish the business and also to live together in London.
Meanwhile, you're still a personal assistant to Yehudi.
Yeah.
Were you like a buffer between him and the... He's one of the most famous people in the world.
Yes,
so truly internationally famous. There must have been, thousands of people clamoring at him for this or for that, wanting him to do this, and probably a million good causes that he couldn't possibly contribute to. So, were you the Praetorian Guard to some degree?
Yes, standing at the dressing room door saying, "No, you can't go in. He's having a rest, or he's rehearsing," or saying to Diana, "I think that might be a charlatan over there, we watch him very carefully and usher them out of the..." That sort of thing was, part of the deal.
I suppose you were in the business of averting disasters before they happened, didn't they? Can you give an example of some of the disasters you might have been able to avert for Yehudi?
Well, yes. Anticipation was part of my job, anticipating when things were about to come unstuck, as it were.
Like when he'd be late for things.
Yes, that sort of thing. And, for instance, the opening of the National Theatre in London was a big event. And I knew that London traffic was rain was coming down. I said, oh, we're not going to get there unless we leave Highgate. The function was to start at 7 o'clock, and I thought 2 hours we'd need to go from Highgate. It's only about 10 kilometres. And the minions were aghast when I said, we're leaving at 5 o'clock. And they said, no, we're not. We'll leave at 6:30, half an hour's more than that. This is early on in my career. But it turned out it took us 2 hours to get there. And they were the only people to get into the hall. The hall was half full when the Queen arrived. And afterwards they said, Philip, from now on, if you say we're leaving at 5, we leave at 5. They were very grateful for that sort of thing.
How close were you to Hepzibah? His sister?
Very. Because I was often taking music to her before a recital, he'd say, look, I want my sister to have the scores to study. And we met at social functions. And, of course, being Australian and her having spent so much time here, we spoke the same language. And she missed Australia, and we often talked about it.
Tell me about the service you were able to do for Hepzibah when she was very unwell. And what was
very unwell. She was dying of cancer. Last tour of America, she was very unwell. And Yehudi had said to me, look, my sister's arriving next week. She'll be unprepared. She is very ill. But I'm insisting that we get on with the tour. I want you to find for me a nice house with a grand piano, have it tuned up. And
why was Yehudi insisting on the tour if she was so unwell?
Good question. The show must go on. And he had this thing about health. If you talked about sickness and illness, you're bound to get worse. He outfaced all of this sort of thing. And he didn't like talking about it.
Right, the path to good health through obstinate denial.
Obstinate denial and get on with the job. And it was courageous in one sense, but very taxing for Hepzibah.
Yes.
So she arrived and we went to this house. But when they started rehearsing, I had forgotten the important thing, which was a page turner. The page turners had been engaged for all the recitals that we were to do, but I hadn't organised a page turner for this particular rehearsal period of 3 or 4 days. And Hepzibah was having trouble. The music was falling off the music stand. So I simply got off my chair where I was writing postcards home and went over to the piano and started turning pages for her. And she turned around and she said, well, thank you very much. And we went on for 3 or 4 days and went through the whole repertoire. Arrived at the concert hall in Miami, 3,000 people packed in, and just before, down the corridor came the professional page turner, ready to do her job. Took her in, introduced her to Hepzibah, and Hepzibah said, oh, Daphne, look, we don't need you tonight. I said, what do you mean? She said, no, Philip, sorry. Daphne, look, Philip, would you give Daphne the ticket that you were going to use, and give her the check. It was $250. Yes, here, Daphne, it's yours. Philip's going to turn pages for me. I said, there's something excuse me. She said, no, Philip, it's marvellous what you've done the last 4 days. You know the repertoire, and it's going to make life so much easier for me. And I don't have to go through it with Daphne and anybody else on the rest of the tour. And so I said, well, actually, there is. She said, Philip, not now. Let me just relax before the performance. Went out on stage, turned pages. We went to 8 cities, Chicago, New York, all around America. And on the way out to the airport to go back to London, Hepzibah, who only had about 6 months to live, lay back in the car and she said, Philip, there's a question I should have asked you back in Miami. Can you read music? And I said, of course not. And she said, but how did you do it? I said, oh, I don't know, I watched your eyes going down the page. What? And I said, those big round notes like donuts. What do you mean notes? And those stick men, if the stick men are there, lots of them, you're busy. But the donut ones, you're slowing down. Oh, she said, don't tell me, I've got a page turner.
She
said, please don't tell anybody. And I probably just told 1,000 people. No.
More than 1,000 indeed. I am with Philip Bailey at the moment, a man who was the personal assistant to Yehudi Menuhin for many, many, many years. Yehudi was quite an emotional man. You saw him cry only, what, I don't know.
Twice
in his life.
His mother taught the children to button up their emotions. His mother was very buttoned up.
Oh, he was quite restrained then, wasn't he?
Very restrained. No, he wasn't emotional at all. And very, very not given to any, not like Diana. Diana was full of, she was like living on top of an emotional volcano, but not Yehudi.
So what made him cry?
One instance, he was about to perform with the BBC Symphony. doing a Bartok concerto, and the conductor knew nothing about Bartok. Yehudi had overstretched himself. He hadn't had time to rehearse properly himself. He was under enormous pressure, and I found him sitting on the edge of a bed in his underclothes, crying his heart out, saying, why do I do this to myself? Why am I on this treadmill?
Well, he just couldn't bear to be mediocre, could he?
No, it had to be the top, and he couldn't bear to think that the English audience, the BBC audience, would hear an inferior. He got over that, and the only other time I saw him cry was when we were on a tour of Australia, and he was telephoning his wife, who was failing in London, and he couldn't bear that thought, so that was a very emotional time. It took some time for him to recover his composure, having put the phone down, and his wife saying, "Where are you, Eddie? Why are you? Where are you?" And so, "I'm in Australia. Why have you gone to Australia?" That sort of thing. And she outlasted him, I must say, but that was very emotional.
How was he with conventional medicine?
Terrible. He loathed antibiotics, wouldn't have a thing to do, and that's what eventually killed him. He should have had massive antibiotics to counteract pleurisy, but he was a great believer in homeopathy. He had a big medicine bag full of pills. He'd take handfuls of them. At every meal, he might have 10 or 15 capsules, and you say to him, "What's in that?" And he'd say, "I don't know, but I feel much better after I've taken them." And they might be crushed antelope hooves and that sort of thing.
What were you doing? What was he doing, I should say, when he died?
He was on a massive tour of Germany. I was here with Tim in Australia going to Sam Bailey's wedding. Remember Sam and Jenny?
Sam and Jenny are previous guests on this program.
Of course.
Yes.
They were having...
you're Sam's uncle, aren't you?
That's right. And he, Sam and Jenny were getting married, and we came out for the wedding. And while we were there, the telephone rang, and the secretary said, "The boss has died." In fact, I heard it on ABC News first and couldn't believe it. I thought they made a mistake. I thought it was Diana who must have died. But so we beetled back to London. There I discovered that he'd gone to Germany to continue this tour and was commuting between German cities and London, looking after his wife or keeping her happy. And he just eventually, his heart gave out. He had a chronic heart condition. And his heart gave out in Berlin because he couldn't cope with a lungs full of fluid. He drowned, in fact. It was terribly sad.
You beat yourself up a bit over that, don't you, Philip?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, because I'm sure, and Tim and I have talked about this a lot, if we'd been in charge, in a sense, on the tour, we would have pulled the plug much earlier. And various people, I still blame them, took their eye off the ball, and... there were vested interests who wanted to keep the tour going. And
it was his life. He made that decision.
Yes,
do you think? True. Do you think he would be... That's why he wanted to die. I mean, pushing himself, yes. working.
In fact, there is a theory that his daughter has, and I know his nephew here in Australia, that perhaps given his physical condition, his hearing was going, and the idea that if he ate properly and exercised properly, he would never... He thought he was omnipotent, really, and his mother lived to over 100. He didn't expect to have this physical frailty, and he was very emotionally disappointed. And there is a theory that, in fact, he terminated. He didn't look after himself in a way that people had always expected him to.
You think working with a man in close... The thing when you work with a man, he was authentically a genius. I mean, there's not much doubt about that. As you say, he spoke all those languages, fiercely brilliant intellect, the greatest violinist of his time, many would say. The thing that leaders like that, and they are leaders, they lift everyone up around them at their best. Was he able to do that for you? Do you think you led a bigger life because...
Oh, yes. Of being huge. Yes, hugely. Brilliant. Because he opened up all of that aspect of human endeavour, which I was in awe of, and I was just a minuscule part of keeping that going, in a sense. And hence it was a great disappointment when his sudden death.
Now you and Tim have retired, is that right?
Yes.
Or are you not retired?
Yes. No, well,
you're back in Australia.
We travel around Australia doing what we're doing now.
Talking about Yehudi.
Yeah, let's go to music clubs and U3A groups and that sort of thing.
I know there's a story you love to tell as you do that about Yehudi. It's a final kind of insight into him as a man. Please tell this story about him and his loathing of national borders.
Well, Sam said, if you don't tell the story, you're dead. So this is for Sam. Rome Airport, 1960s. Yehudi's arriving to give in early in the morning to give a recital at night at the airport in Rome. Lined up in the customs hall are all the officials, about six of them. And Yehudi hated officialdom at airports. He had a particular dislike of immigration officials.
Yeah, national borders, we're all know, one, all finish, one people, no, we don't need national borders. Yes.
And whenever he saw a queue, he knew there was a bureaucrat at the and he used to be very tense at airports. And he walked into the customs hall and walked straight past all the officials. The head official said, hey, not so fast. Here, you come back here. Yes, you. You're carrying that. Yes, come back, this case. Here, put your case here. Put it on there. Right. Give me your passport. Ah, here it is. Hey, boys, we've got another one. Another white boss. Another Yehudi Menuhin. I think, well, I am Yehudi Menuhin. Oh, that's what they all say. Who said Yehudi? He said, the violin smugglers. Okay, you say this is a genuine passport, and now you're going to tell me in this case here, you've got a genuine Stradivari violin. And he said, well, that's exactly what's in there. He said, well, show me. Open up. Must I? Yes, open up. So Yehudi opens up there and presents a violin for inspection. And Yehudi said, look, there's a label inside here. It says Antonio Stradivari, 1733. Oh, boys, this man here, he's got a violin with a label in it. They've all got labels in it. I know that. How's this proof? This is Stradivari. So if you think you're Yehudi Menuhin and Stradivari, you play something. Play now. So Yehudi said, oh, I've got to humour him. And he thought, okay, what I'll do, I'll play something that I'm playing tonight in the recital. It'll mean I'm warming up and rehearsing at the same time. He loved doing two things at once. So he launched into this piece. At the end of which, quite a few people in the customs hall applauded. And Yehudi thought, well, I got through that. And the official said, that produces nothing. My daughter, she can play that. Now, I happen to know something. If you're Yehudi Menuhin, who you say you are, You can play solo Bach like nobody else on earth. So play solo Bach and play now. So what you're about to hear is you're really playing the preludio from the Partita of Bach, Partita number 3 in E. At this stage, of course, there were quite a crowd had appeared and applause. And the head charang said to Yehudi, okay, you can play Bach, and you must be Yehudi Menuhin. Here's your passport. Put your violin away. And as he was putting the violin away, the head charang put his arm around Yehudi and said, Maestro, you're a good sport. And you say, what do you mean a good sport? He said, don't get angry. No, please don't get angry with me. This morning I had a problem. All of my colleagues here were sitting backstage having a cup of coffee and saying, isn't it sad? Yehudi Menuhin was going to come through here shortly. And we all tried to get tickets for his recital tonight and it was booked out. So I said, leave it to Papa. And they said, what are you going to do? I said, we'll have our own private recital here in the airport. And they said, no, he won't be in it. He wouldn't do this. As you do. How much you bet me? How much? So all of my friends, they've bet me a lot of money. Maestro, you've made me a very happy and a very wealthy man. Have a lovely time in Rome.
And did he take it like a good sport?
Yes, he did. Well, he tells that story against himself, in a sense. Yeah, he realised in the end that he was...
What a lovely story. That's a beautiful story. Yeah. And he was, in the end, he gave this impromptu performance in the middle of the most boring place in the world, which is an airport, customs and immigration desk.
To humour these... and it says a lot about Italians and about Yehudi, I think, as well.
It does. It's been lovely hearing your story and your life with Yehudi Menuhin. Philip, it's such a pleasure having you on the program, and thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And thank you to your nephew, Sam, and Sam Bailey and Jenny Bailey, who suggested you coming on the show. And Philip is the author of a 2-volume biography of Yehudi Menuhin that's called Yehudiana, Reliving the Menuhin Odyssey.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. Help yourself to as many as you like at abc.net.au/conversations. And on iTunes as well.